On this episode of ID the Future, David Klinghoffer continues his interview of mathematician David Berlinski and biochemist Michael Denton. They delve into the difficulties of Darwinian evolution as a viable modern theory of the origin and development of life in the cosmos. On this episode, Berlinski explains why many conservative intellectuals have trouble doubting Darwin. Denton suggests that the mechanistic Darwinian framework will eventually collapse and reviews the essential differences in worldview between the Darwin supporter and the Darwin doubter. Tune in to the final episode of this stimulating exchange.
David, I've been watching your interviews with Peter Robinson on
Uncommon Knowledge,
which I thought was great. And I was gratified to... Robinson says very clearly he's on your side.
Yes.
And I thought it was very significant that, I mean, National Review is running this series of interviews, it's a pleasant surprise, because often, surprisingly, on the right, on the political right, even though this issue has been politicized, as you say, conservative intellectuals are very frequently hostile to Darwin doubting.
Oh, I know that. I've encountered that myself. I've had splendid interviews with conservative intellectuals in their offices going through the arguments. I won't mention names. There's no reason to.
Right.
And they say, you know, Dave, those are great arguments. You should be making them. They said, X, I have been making them. I've been making them for 20 years. I made them at Commentary until they kicked me out of Commentary.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I wonder why that was.
Yeah.
What, you want me to tell you why I haven't been very successful in gaining an organ of publicity? No. And then the light dawns in their pale blue eyes. The light is very easily explained. The conservative intellectuals take an immense pleasure in thinking of themselves as intellectuals. God forbid they should be associated with evangelicals who might pull a snake from a pocket.
Yeah.
Or might mumble something about biblical inerrancy.
Right.
There's a real fear of a decline in social status by finding oneself associated with one's natural enemies that is at work in the conservative community. Mm-hmm. It's at work in every aspect of the conservative community. They struggle so hard for respectability, these people, after William Buckley made conservatism essentially respectable, and they're terrified of losing that respectability.
And that's an element of Templeton as well.
Yeah, it's an element of Templeton. It goes right through. Can you imagine one of these guys in New York? You know, they have the really good suit, but not the top suit, the Paul Scott suit. And they've got the tie that doesn't quite go because they don't know enough to pull off that style.
Yeah.
And some grizzled farmer from Mississippi emerges on 34th Street in Midtown Manhattan and puts a manure-reeking hand over their shoulder and says, Irving, we're on the same boat. That's a terrifying thought.
I wonder if they also don't grasp or haven't really thought about why this issue matters, why it should matter to them and to their readers and to their constituency.
Some have. You know, when I wrote for Commentary, Neil Cossett, I understood that perfectly well.
You understood why it matters.
Yes. But the real power, John Podoretz, who founded, his power was merited, condign, he didn't think it mattered.
So how would you explain we won't go into personalities, but to a conservative intellectual who doesn't get why it matters, who would say, you know, David, you're right, I agree with you, but, you know, this just is not our issue. And let's say that he's not motivated by social anxiety. Let's say he just, let's give him the benefit of the doubt, he just doesn't see why it's an issue. Why are we talking about this? How would you explain, why does this matter?
I don't know whether I could explain why it matters any more than I could explain why it matters that we have a theory explaining the origin of the universe or the development of the galaxies, or that there are conceptual weaknesses in physical theories that should be addressed. I mean, you both encountered the same thing. Mozart, it kind of tinkles in the background, but it doesn't really matter to me, Mozart, the music of Bach, booms. I prefer not to listen to that. And with respect to what I think are the great, riveting, powerful questions of our age, there are people who say, tant pis, it's not very interesting. Or they will say, as has often been said to me, how does this affect the Jews? Mm-hmm. How does it affect Israel? Give me the connection.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, well, it doesn't affect the Jews. It affects any thinking human being. Well, lots of things that affect thinking human beings, but we can't cover everything.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid at that point, there's very little I can do. If someone is not intrinsically attracted by these ideas, who doesn't find his soul, to a certain extent, on fire at the stupendousness,
stupendousness,
of what he's being asked to contemplate, what can you say? I know people who look at general relativity. Good mathematician. Just another field. Why should I pay attention to that? And Einstein kind of doctored it up with a lot of fancy doodads. And look, this is essentially the view of Steven Weinberg. Einstein introduced another field, the gravitational field. I mean, you know, there's a division in physics between those who worship at the shrine of general relativity and those who don't. Mm-hmm. And those who worship at the shrine cannot understand why the other physicists are not transfixed by the beauty of those equations, that equation, the field equation. So there's very little we can say or do. And believe me, I've been in New York, I've been in Washington, I've talked to a lot of guys. Every now and then you get a convert like Ann Coulter.
Yeah.
Ann Coulter's been remarkably successful, you know, in a way that we can't be.
Yeah.
And she's just published two columns, really bashing Darwin at the New York Times.
Yeah.
And
so have you found that, David, over the last 20 years with your activities, have you made, I mean, you mentioned one convert, right? I mean, have you how many people do you think you've influenced? I mean, from feedback you've got all?
I've got, I think anybody who writes, who publishes, develops, unless they're just wretched, nobody wants to read them, a kind of fan club. And like every other writer who writes on scientific topics or mathematical topics, I have a fan club. People who say, well, until I heard you, until I heard you speak, until blah, blah, blah. And after that, the scales fell from my eyes. I think there's a certain amount of change that's taking place. But real change always takes place in the generation that's coming up, not the generation that's passing on. I could have Richard Dawkins in a room for a century without being able to change his mind. Well, the first 99 years, he would be unwilling to speak to me, that's for sure. But starved for company, he would break down in the 99th year.
Yeah.
But the only thing he would say is, you're wrong.
Yeah.
I always assign Richard Dawkins a New York accent as a courtesy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the Darwinian sort of framework will, when we were talking about this earlier, I mean, it'll collapse with the general framework of, you know, the sort of mechanistic sort of reductionist framework. That's going to collapse. I think that is going to go. So something's going to give eventually.
The question that I keep asking myself is the whole framework of Western science going to collapse?
That's a deeper question.
For some reason, nobody at the Discovery Institute is too eager to ask that question.
please go on. You know, I mean,
it's really a dramatic example of repairing the lifeboat at sea if we make that thesis. But it is a question, you know. No system of thought lasts forever. We're talking about a system of thought that began end of the 16th century with Kepler and Copernicus, taking very daring steps about what they were thinking. Everything in modern science is right there in Kepler. Kepler is asking questions that are obviously modern scientific. Why is the distance between the planets what it is? It's a question that occurs in biology. Why don't pigs have wheels? Mm-hmm. And he's proposing answers. They're wrong, but he's proposing answers mm-hmm. in terms of the Platonic solids. When you get to Galileo and Newton, you have essentially modern science. All the parts of the revolution occur within a period of 10 years. Mm-hmm. Astonishing. Mm-hmm. The most profound revolution in human thought takes place in 10 years. By the time Newton publishes the Principia, 1685, 1686, the greatest work in the scientific imagination had already been written. Hmm. Nothing ever comes close to that again. Nothing. Hmm. But how long can that last? I mean, we can say exactly what Newton did, how he made the revolution. He applied mathematics to physics. That's the revolution. That's interesting. No biologist does that. Mm. There is no mathematics in biology.
Yeah.
Why is that?
It's funny as well. In fact, David, looking back on the scientific revolution, it was very much a revolution in physics.
Yeah.
And from the very beginning, biology was excluded in a sense.
That's right.
Because Aristotle, of course, made the universe biological, and physics had to bend to biology. Whereas since the 17th century, biologists had to bend to physics. I mean, it's a generalization.
I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah. Mm. And, for instance, Descartes had to exclude the mind, you see, and agency from his, you know, for, yeah, he said, this is epiphenomenal. I can't handle this mechanically. I can't handle this in terms of the new physics, so we'll ignore it. I mean, that is one of the biggest extraordinary, you know, ad hoc moves in history, actually, to do that. In other words, what he was doing was he was excluding biology, really, from science.
Mm.
Because you can't exclude mind, agency, you know, this sort of stuff. I mean, it's the essence of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway.
It's not as if what Mike is saying has not ever been said before. You know, Alfred Wallace was commonly credited with co-discovering Darwin's theory of evolution. And he did. It's true. He entered a number of very, very serious reservations about this theory that he had helped create. And in particular, he said it does nothing to explain the paradox of language, the paradox of music, the paradox of mathematics, the paradox of dance, artistic tradition, scientific interpretation. These are all waiting to be explained. They can't be explained by a Darwinian mechanism.
Hmm.
There's no accretion involved in any of this.
You're sitting on the African plains, David.
Yeah.
Would you rather contemplate a beautiful sunset or be able to run as fast as Usain Bolt?
Absolutely. See, there are... The history is not properly presented. I mean, there have been substantial criticisms all along the way, and I count Wallace as an immensely important critique.
I've sometimes daydreamed about having a Darwin critic and a Darwinist in the same room, and having not a debate but a very focused, argumentative conversation between the two of them. And you mentioned being in a room with Dawkins, not someone like Dawkins, but someone who's honest and not a propagandist and not a bomb thrower. And if we made you sit in the room until you got down to the nub of the issue that divides you from him, what would it be?
It's so hard to say, David. I suspect that when you ask a question like that, you are exhibiting a desire for acceptance completely at odds with the reality of the situation. It's very hard to imagine that kind of discussion actually proceeding toward the nub. I see it much more realistically fracturing into a thousand divagations and small points of petty dispute without any sense of resolution. You know, it's very hard for us to accept that rational debate, rational discussion, rational criticism, these are very weak instruments. They don't do much.
But what I would say would be, in fact, basically the Darwinist accepts, you know, a quite different ontological status of biological systems to myself. And this is a deep problem, right? He accepts the idea a priori that biological systems are essentially machine-like contingent arrangements of elements, right? I deny that, and I ask him to prove it. And I've also used that in debates as well, and it's a very powerful point. Because you see, the thing is that the Darwinian view depends on the a priori presumption of a contingent order, you see? And once you ask him, this goes back to typology again.
Yeah.
Well, what I mean is that they're assuming from the very beginning that Darwinism is right.
Yeah.
By their framework, their ontological framework, is that living things are contingent, non-natural arrangements of elements. That's what they're once you say, is that right? Wow. What are you going to do now, you see?
Mm.
And it's obvious when you think of the extraordinary nature of existence itself. That's a huge assumption about biological systems, right? Mm. And you can bring this out in debate, actually. The difference I have with the Darwinist is I don't accept his premise that the ontological status of living things are a random, you know, non-natural assemblages of matter. That's his assumption. If he questions that assumption, he can't have Darwinism.
Yeah.
Because Darwinism is a sort of subsidiary theory on that fundamental conception of what the ontological status of living things is.
Yeah. Is it almost as though the top-down folks are talking right by the bottom-up folks? Is not a fair
incommensurability? You can't show who's right, Aristotle or Descartes. You see, I mean, the point is that you can't, that decision can't, he's decided that Descartes is right. He's decided, he's bent biology to physics, right?
To a certain extent, everyone talks past everyone else. And the moment of coincidence, the moment of concord, these are really rare. And they don't arise because people agree to sit down in a room and have an honest discussion. Newton prevailed the moment Principia Mathematica was published, because it simply stomped over everything. It was huge. It was like a mastodon in intellectual life. And no one could stand up against it. No one had the mathematical power, to utter the slightest word in criticism. And when somebody, when some poor schnook said something or other, Newton gave a magnificent response. He says, "I don't trifle with mathematical smatterers."
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Wonderful, yeah.
Mathematical smatterers. But then after the Principia had been published, one of the Bernoulli brothers posed a problem about the line of least descent. And none of the mathematicians in Europe could solve it. Newton was working at the Mint. He came home after dinner, dead tired, beat. His niece gave it to him, and by 10 o'clock he had solved it, sent it off anonymously. Mm. And the response from Bernoulli was, "This is Newton. He hadn't signed it. How do you know?" "I recognize the lion by its paw."
This has been ID the Future with David Berlinski and Michael Denton. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2015. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.